It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania just reelected its incumbent governor, Tom Wolf, but come January, the state will have a new right-hand man. Joining me in studio is Lieutenant Governor-elect John Fetterman. John, thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure and an honor.
So, you've won the office of Lieutenant Governor, but you're still the mayor of Braddock. Do you plan on resigning that position
that's a good question. Here's what I did. I contacted council, a vice president of council, who's a good personal friend of mine. And I said, what would be in the town's best interest? And I turned it over to them. If they would like me to resign immediately, I will. If they would like me to stay on until the absolute moment where I'm inaugurated, whatever they believe is in the town's best interest, that's where we left it.
And okay. I'm waiting to hear. When you became Mayor Braddock, what did you see then, and what were your hopes for the community at that time?
Well, it was a community that I had already loved and was living in for a couple of years. I had been in Braddock since 2001. I came there in the summer of 2001 to run some programming for young people, get their GEDs, get employment, get their lives back on track, and was happy to do that. And then ended up running for mayor, didn't expect to, after two of my students lost their lives through gun violence, and ran an improbable campaign, one by one vote, as the story goes. And what I saw in 2006 was a community that had been so badly neglected and ignored and marginalized, and sought to get it going. But it was immediately brought into stark relief, the challenges. It was devastating. About 2 weeks after I took office, a pizza delivery man was shot to death just doing his job in our community. And that was the first time I had seen that up close, and that drove home what was at stake, and that's really how things started.
All right, started then, but when you were elected, what were your hopes to say, what can I legitimately accomplish?
Well, my hope was that we want to get a conversation going, that these kind of communities and places and the folks that live there matter in the conversation, and they are deserving of investment. We all have a constitutional right to live in an improving jurisdiction. Now, that's not to say equal. I mean, I'm not saying, let's put Walnut Street down on Braddock Avenue. That's not what it means. But it means that you shouldn't hear gunshots at night. You should have basic amenities and services. You should have playgrounds for your children. Things of that nature.
Sounds like a lot of quality of life issues and even sort of self-image to...
I can't tell you, even to this day, on the campaign trail across the state, I've met a steelworker that said, man, 15, 20 years ago, I wouldn't even want to drive through downtown Braddock at night when I got off of work. I would circle around, and now it's completely different. And quality of life issues were the most important. We didn't have any functioning playground. We didn't have nearly the kind of youth activities that we needed. We needed to start from the very, very basic. We needed an ATM. The only food available in the community was the UPMC cafeteria at the hospital. Now, when you think quality cuisine, hospital food is always like the butt of the joke. And then, of course, as everyone knows, we lost that a couple years later when UPMC closed the hospital. So just, really every logistical and infrastructural challenge.
All right. So what would you still like to have accomplished? He's still okay. We've made improvements, but boy, if I were still mayor, I would still want to do this.
Well, it's just ongoing aspirational stuff. There's a lot of things that we'd like to do. We've set a lot of things in motion and accomplished a lot more. I my one overriding wish has always been and always will be just a more healthy, just, and equitable outcome for everybody. One that is free of violence. One that is free of not having heat, not one that is free of a lot of different issues, and it's never going to be done there. And I'm not relocating to Harrisburg or living in the Lieutenant Governor's mansion, I'm staying in Braddock, and because these are the places and the communities and the people that really matter to me.
All right. So let's you have said that prior to being elected. Yeah. So why are you staying in Braddock? I mean, obviously, you said you love Braddock, but why are you staying there, not in Harrisburg?
Well, I think the primary reason is I love it. It's my home. It's my community. All three of our children were born there. But symbolically as well, too, I believe it's inappropriate, for lack of a better phrase, to have a public servant, which you are if you are in this kind of office, living in a home that has housekeeping. I mean, all these other things. That's just not when we've worked to eliminate people that have had their gas and heat shut off. I mean, these are issues that Pennsylvanians are confronting. And for me to live there, it's just not my look. And I think it's important to set that tone.
Any idea what should happen to the, quote, Lieutenant Governor's house?
Well, my wife is we're working on it, and I met with the governor yesterday, and he's fully supportive, enthusiastic about these ideas. So it's going to be one that involves everybody, or a use that has nothing to do with creating having creature comforts for my family at the taxpayer expense. That, you know, but it's going to involve the public, whether it's children in the pool, using the pool during the summer, children that wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to swim. It's just going to be used for it belongs to the people, and that's what it's going to involve.
Is it publicly owned land, or is it private that's rented, and can you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the state owns it. The state owns it.
All right. So what do you hope to accomplish over the next 4 years as Lieutenant Governor? Has the governor talked to you about specifics, he'd like you to tackle?
Well, let me just say the governor did an amazing job during his first term, and I'm honored to be his partner. And during our conversation yesterday, you know, he made it clear that we want to be a partner in all these. And he's a really wonky guy, and he gets excited by
about these kind of,
Yeah. And his face lights up when he gets to talk about policy, because he's not a politician, quote unquote, in that regard. And he has just been so gracious and wants us to be fully participatory and work through issues, whether it's criminal justice reform, whether it's economic development issues, particularly in more marginalized places that exist out here in the Mon Valley, for example. Things of that nature are really in my wheelhouse, things that I've spent my professional career involved in. So I'm really looking forward to working with the governor. We had a great working relationship during our campaign, and Pennsylvania is just lucky to have him.
Okay. In Braddock, you were the top executive. As Lieutenant Governor, you won't be. Do you anticipate that being second in command could have some limitations on what you can accomplish?
Not at all. I clearly understand my role, and it's a great honor. And Governor Wolf has done an extraordinary job turning around a situation that he inherited 4 years ago in 2014. And my job is what my title is, Lieutenant Governor, and that is to assist and to have his back. And I'm lucky to have a governor that wants participation and wants that, and he deserves that from me, and that's what I'm committed to.
You mentioned marginalized communities. You've spoken out about wanting to be a champion of forgotten places across Pennsylvania, such as Braddock. So how will you try to be a voice for those communities?
Well, as I have been as mayor, and reminding people that these places are deserving of investment. These places are deserving of attention and focus. And
private investment or state investment?
All of them. With some of these communities like ours, you need a mix. You need an absolute mix, because if you have to rely entirely on the private sector, money follows its own interest. It's not that kind of a situation. You need a mix of philanthropic support, public dollars, private dollars, and moving along those ways as we've done. And there are a lot of communities in and around the region, for example, that are near and dear to me, and I've been to many of them across the state. And I really want to be a voice, because I know how important a particular project might be, and being able to have a voice and a platform that I have, I want to make sure that those communities have the best chance of being heard and getting that kind of attention and investment.
What about the communities that don't look like Braddock. Sure. Will you be an advocate for them as well?
Well, of course. But I think if you're looking on the spectrum of Upper St. Clair, it's a beautiful, one of the most affluent communities in Pennsylvania. They don't need that kind of attention. And then you contrast that to McKeesport, where the life expectancy between those two communities, even though they're well within Allegheny County, not too far from each other, is over a decade long. I mean, so those are the kind of places. Whatever you want to call that, social justice, whatever you want to call that, I think important is that places like McKeesport continually get the kind of reinvestment and attention that they deserve and they need to close that gap. I'm personally appalled by that. You know, we shouldn't be having an entire decades separating our life expectancies when we're living 15 minutes apart from each other.
What will you take from your work in Braddock to inform the way you approach your new position?
I would take what we've just discussed, this idea that there are a lot of places there that you can't take a lot for granted. And one of the things that I'm most proud of that we've done in Braddock is we've eliminated heating insecurity. We've partnered with the local People's Gas. And every fall, they send us a list of homes that have had their gas shut off. I believe heat is a basic fundamental human – warmth is a fundamental human right. And last year they didn't have any names, and this year there's three, and we're actively working on now getting those turned back on. And these are just folks that they're not scofflaws; they're just folks that, you know, they're working hard, and they just can't keep up with a gas bill, and they fall $100 or $200 behind. You know, they don't want that. People's doesn't want that, and they've been a wonderful partnership with that. And if that can be replicated on a larger scale, that's what I would like to do. And taking that kind of background there, and I think there's a lot that we can accomplish. I'm looking forward to taking it on.
Braddock Mayor John Fetterman will become Pennsylvania's new lieutenant governor in January. Congratulations, and thanks for being here.
Well, and please, before I go, I just want to emphasize my gratitude to everybody for their votes and their supports. I'm just so grateful to everyone.
You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, it's known as the Forgotten War. But author Hampton Sides says there are a lot of lessons left to glean from the conflict in Korea not so long ago. Manassas Mayor Matt Shira has gained as much attention for not attending meetings as any other part of his platform. Coming up, the first-time executive speaks for himself. And later, a look at Pittsburgh's rich wrestling history through the eyes of one of its most promising coaches. Those conversations and more as The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Jewish Reform Movement document known as the Pittsburgh Platform is adopted in 1885. The ideological shift was the result of several days of meetings by Jewish Reformed rabbis in downtown Pittsburgh. It included a rejection of strictly ritualistic laws, calling instead for a return to moral and ethical laws. The move came at a time when Pittsburgh's Jewish population was growing rapidly, and the city served as a central meeting place for New York and Ohio Jewish leaders. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Originally called Armistice Day, Sunday marked the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Now it's known as Veterans Day, a day to honor all those who have served past and present. That includes the 2,300 Western Pennsylvanians who lost their lives in the Korean War, roughly 6% of the 67,000 Americans killed during that conflict. We're joined now by author Hampton Sides. His new book is titled On Desperate Ground. Hampton, welcome to The Confluence.
Good to be with you.
Hampton, 65 years after the end of the Korean War, what got you to write about it, but more specifically, a very important battle?
Well, like most of my books, it began with meeting somebody, in this case, a veteran of the Battle of Chosin Reservoir, and I noticed that he was missing a finger, and he explained that he had suffered from frostbite in the battle, because this was a battle that was fought in ridiculously cold weather, 35 below zero. He said, you know, you should write about the reservoir. You should write about this amazing battle. And, of course, I had never heard of it. And like so many Americans, really, I knew very little about anything to do with the Korean War. It is our forgotten war. It's sort of kind of an asterisk in the national consciousness. And so I thought, you know, maybe I should look into this a little further. And not only that, but these are the guys, my parents' generation, the Korean War generation, these are the ones that are exiting the stage right now. And we're saying, unfortunately, saying goodbye to them. And, you know, it just impressed upon me the importance of getting their stories down before it was too late. And they're passing with some mystification and resentment that, you know, their experiences are so widely forgotten, in, you know, especially among the younger generations.
For those of us who don't know that particular battle, remind us of the significance of that.
There's something kind of classical about this battle. It has a certain feel about it that a group of men, in this case the 1st Marine Division, that marches 70 miles up into the mountains when winter descends upon them, and they come to a frozen lake up in the mountains when they are realize that they are completely surrounded by Mao's red Chinese soldiers. Over 120,000 of them have been sort of setting this trap. And, you know, the Marines basically just have to hold on for dear life for 4 or 5 days, fighting off wave after wave after wave of the enemy. And then they have to regroup, bashing their way out of this trap all the way back down that same road to the sea, where an enormous evacuation takes place. And it also is our most decorated battle in modern American history.
Our military men and women are often caught in the middle of political disputes. How do you approach that in your book, examining the politics that led to this war and ultimately to this battle?
Right. Well, you know, this was really the opening salvo of the Cold War. President Truman trying to figure out how to confront world communism, and you know what Stalin was doing in Eastern Europe was quite terrifying and worrisome to Truman, and what was happening in Asia was equally worrisome. And you know, Mao had just won his civil war, and he was beginning to flex his muscles, and having been part of the Japanese Empire after World War II, we kind of carved up Korea, and the Soviets got the North, we got the South. We were trying to sort of remake South Korea into a democracy, and of course, Stalin had turned North Korea into a puppet state. So, you know, basically, unfortunately, this peninsula that had been batted around by the forces of history for so long was just carved up and was the plaything of these larger geopolitical forces.
I mentioned the number of lives lost. In addition, among those who hailed from Pennsylvania, almost 600 military personnel were still unaccounted for as of earlier this year. That's the second largest number in the entire country. In June, President Trump met with the North Korean leader. The president said later that North Korea had agreed to return the remains of more than 200 U.S. or allied service members. What's the return of the remains mean for the families?
Well, for most of the families that I've talked to, you know, it means everything. There's just something about knowing with absolute finality that your loved one did die and has been found. It gives a certain level of closure for these families. A lot of these guys that you're talking about, these remains, are coming from the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. And it's also just a testament to the fact that this war really, for so many Americans, still isn't over. It's there wasn't a formal peace treaty.
Right.
We're still living with a lot of the consequences along that frightening place we call the DMZ. And, you know, this war is still alive.
And that's another reason that we should remember this forgotten war. The fact that there are many, many active duty personnel right along that DMZ.
Yes, it's still a very scary place. I was just there a few months ago with a bunch of Korean War veterans, and we went to three or four places along the DMZ, and you know, you look out across that barbed wire and you look across the minefields and you get a glimpse of this really terrifying police state that is North Korea, that, you know, South Korea could very well have been that. You know, it's quite sobering.
Hampton Sides is the author of a new book on desperate ground. Hampton, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Matt Shirah is wrapping up his first year as mayor of Monessen. And as mayor, he's also the president of Monessen Council. The 27-year-old ran on a campaign of addressing blight in the city while preserving historic buildings. But recently he's gained more attention for not attending council's meetings. Shirah spoke with 90.5 WESA's Kylie Kaczynski for The Confluence.
So you've only been in office since January of this year, but you've already gotten a fair amount of criticism. Mm-hmm. Is it true that you've not attended a Monessen council meeting since May?
That is true.
Why is that?
I think it was about my second day of office. I found out that there were questions with the Monessen police pension, and the pension fund administrator was rebid out, and the previous fund administrator was fired. And they hired our solicitor's brother 2 weeks before I took office. So I felt that that was a little questionable. So I contacted the Auditor General, DePasquale. So they looked into it. My counsel refused to acknowledge that it was a problem. I expressed that it was a concern. They just kind of brushed it off. So come April, we had a preliminary meeting with the Auditor General's office. And when they expressed concern about the potential Act 44 violations and conflicts of interest, my counsel got really angry. They were screaming that it was all political and how dare I go to the state over this and this is ridiculous. So then the following month in May, I went to the work session, which was on May 10th, I believe. And then counsel before the meeting said, well, we don't want you here. You need to resign. If you quit, this will all go away. You need to stop talking to the press. You tell people too many things.
This is counsel talking to
you. Yes, yeah. And counsel and my solicitor. And I'm like, I'm not going. You know, you do what you need to do. I'll do what I need to do. And I walked out. And so they had the meeting. They read this big proclamation that was basically a vote of no confidence for me. Because they were like, if you don't resign, we're going to read this. And I was just like, sure, go ahead.
Auditor General Eugene DePasquale said that the state won't contribute any future state pension aid until the council selects a new fund manager.
Correct.
And they also expect the city to return nearly $55,000 to the police pension fund after a retired police officer received a potentially erroneous payment.
Correct. The Auditor General's audit speaks for itself, I think. And
what does that mean for the police pension fund?
Well, at the end of the year, it means that we're going to have a roughly $160,000 hole in the budget.
In a way to sort of address this, you've been skipping the council meetings.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to someone who says, how can you lead council if you're not attending the meetings, if you're, you know, you're not in the ring to do battle, to get done what you want to get done? If you're not there, how are you leading council?
Mm-hmm. So I obviously, as mayor, I have one vote. Council has made it very clear that I have one vote. So obviously voting against it is taking a stand, but it's not doing anything proactively. My council doesn't do a very good job of keeping me in the loop with certain things. The city administrator also doesn't do a very good job of keeping me in the loop.
And what would you say to someone who says that you would be in the loop if you were at the council meetings?
While I would be more so in the loop, it wouldn't be effective because most of the public doesn't go to the council meetings. And in most cases, when I explain to residents what's going on, they had no idea. And when I explained to them about all of the situations that I'm concerned about that council doesn't want to remedy, then they're really offended because it's negatively impacting their tax dollars.
Are there any good faith steps that members of council can take to bring you back to the table to kickstart discussions on how to move forward on these issues you've brought up?
Resolve all of the issues that have been brought up. Right now, I'm not convinced of any of them that they have any interest in remedying the issues. which is why I'm looking to the state and the federal government to step in and do what they can for the residents.
Is that your long-term strategy to involve state agencies in trying to rectify some of these situations?
Yeah, and I think that that's the only way that the city is going to ultimately move forward is, you know, try to bring development and try to bring new residents and help the residents that are there. We need to get the administration straightened out.
So another issue facing Monessen is blight. More mm-hmm. than 300 buildings in town were deemed deteriorating about 2 years ago.
I guess the positive is most of them are in one area. They're pretty contained for the most part.
Where is the area?
It's in an older section of Monessen. It spans probably like 4 or 5 square blocks. That's where the bulk of them are. So I guess there's room for opportunity. And I always try to tell people, you know, people think of blight as a bad thing, and it obviously is a public health and safety hazard, but you also need to think of blight as an opportunity, because you can look at these properties and say, okay, out of all of these, what is salvageable? What needs to come down? Can we consolidate lots? Can we encourage people to take side lots and, you know, make their yards bigger? Can we encourage people to build new structures? So really, it creates a new opportunity, because land is something that you can't create. So we have the space.
So you campaigned in part on a platform to preserve Monessen's more historic structures, including a former bank building on Donner Avenue. There haven't been any moves towards restoring or tearing that building down. So what do you intend to do with it? Mm-hmm.
So the city currently owns the building. I didn't abandon the project. I still believe that the building would be a great asset to the city. And there currently the building that has collapsed next door is being demolished. So there will be a really large empty lot next to it. So there's definitely still opportunity there.
What do you make of all this attention that you're getting?
It's been quite stressful, but I'm glad that people are talking about Monessen. And although it might not be in a positive way right now, I think there's a tension on the situations there, and hopefully that will bring about change, positive change, with all of the publicity, because the residents are certainly paying attention to what's going on.
Monessen Mayor Matt Shira speaking with WESA's Kylie Kaczynski for The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. When you think of Pittsburgh and professional wrestling, maybe Olympic gold medal winner turned sports entertainer Kurt Angle comes to mind. Or perhaps you think of that iconic Italian superstar Superman Bruno Sammartino. Or maybe the infamous Hell in a Cell match at the Old Civic Arena between The Undertaker and Mankind 20 years ago. Pittsburgh has a rich wrestling history and an ongoing future in it as well. Here to share his knowledge and experience is local independent pro wrestler, Iron City Wrestling's head trainer, Chris LaRusso. Chris, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me this morning. I'm looking forward to this.
So what's your background in professional wrestling? When did you decide you wanted to become one? Was it something you saw and said, I want to do that?
I think I wanted to do this since I was 6 years old. And we were speaking a little bit before we went on the air about my earliest memory is of professional wrestling and watching professional wrestling with my father at the time, WWF Superstars on Saturday mornings. And it's a love that I have had my entire life that eventually when I became old enough to begin training, it was as soon as I could, I started training and I have loved it my entire life, loved it since 6 years old.
Okay, well, speaking of training, as an independent professional wrestler, what's your routine? What's your lifestyle like?
Well, right now, training at the Iron City Wrestling Academy is 3 days a week, and it is a – I always tell people when they decide to become a professional wrestler, you just decided to take a second full-time job, because even if your events are only on Saturdays, Sundays, Fridays occasionally – you have to train every day, whether it's at the training building, whether it's in the gym, whether it's changing your eating habits, your diet, your road work, everything like that. It becomes a second full-time job, and you have to continue to improve yourself every single day.
You mentioned the academy. I mean, how much of an interest is there in young people wanting to become professional wrestlers?
I think that there's a great surge of interest in professional wrestling these days. especially with women. The WWE has started its women's revolution, which has opened a lot of people's eyes that there is a future and there is opportunity for women in professional wrestling. And at the Iron City Wrestling Academy, our classes are full now for the past 3 years. We have about 15 young men and women who are training right now to follow their dreams, to see if they have what it takes to not only become a professional wrestler here locally, but to see if they can take it to the next level.
Aside from that interest, how have you seen wrestling change in the 15 years since you've been training?
Wrestling has gone through a lot of changes, not only with, I think, the move to a more family-friendly product as it moved away from the late 90s and early 2000s into something that was a little more PG. Mm-hmm. So we've seen the wrestling business change in that way. But I also think technology has changed the business a lot more. And with social media and with the WWE Network and the internet, people have a greater connection to the wrestlers now. People have a greater opportunity to see into their lives and to see everything that goes into their favorite wrestlers. And they feel a lot closer and a lot more connected to them than I think they might have in the past.
So you mentioned the academy. How much is it split between your teaching technique, moves, holds, and versus teaching the entertainment components of it?
They're both absolutely vital to be a successful professional wrestler. We teach the technique and the physicality early. If you don't have that, you run the risk of not only seriously injuring yourself, but seriously injuring your opponent. So we take a strong focus very early that you're not only technically sound, but that you are in good enough physical shape that you can withstand the impacts and to continue to perform at a high level even when you're exhausted. Anyone can do 30 seconds to a minute. Let's see how good you are 5, 10, 20, 40 minutes into a match. Is your technique still good? Is your execution still flawless? And that is what really becomes difficult as the training evolves. And after that, well, now we got to sell some tickets. We have to have something that captivates people, that makes them want to put their smartphone down, to get out of their house, and to come out and see the show. So you've got to cultivate that. You've got to cultivate people being the best versions of themselves. And that takes time.
Right. We have just a few minutes left. Really, how much practicing of the physical nature of it can you really do because of the pounding on the body?
You have to have your techniques and your basics down pat. So you do have to go through a fair amount of physical punishment. You do have to coin a phrase, learn how to fall. And your body hardens and gets conditioned to that kind of punishment. And you go through that so that you are able to take those bumps, to take that impact, to take that punishment when the red light goes on and we have a crowd to entertain.
All right. Briefly, can you sort of assess Pittsburgh's role in the history of professional wrestling?
Pittsburgh, all the way back to Bruno Sammartino, to Kurt Angle, to Elias on WWE today. We've had a great history of producing world champions, producing great professional wrestlers throughout history. I hope that Pittsburgh will continue to do that, continue to produce high quality, amazing entertainers that will entertain generations for years to come.
All right. So this past Saturday, you took on Wardlow at IWC's Winner Take. Have to bring it up. Unfortunately, you did not win.
No.
But you did break a record. You say you got to sell the tickets. You did break a record for pre-sale tickets. So when you're a wrestler, is it more important about winning or, you know, putting on a show, putting on an entertaining show?
Well, if the heir apparent were to be here and telling you that he
All
never
right,
loses.
Who's the heir apparent?
Of course.
You?
Well, oh, of course. You're in the presence of the heir apparent, Chris LaRusso, the greatest professional wrestler of all time. If you ask, if you were to ask him, you've got to win and do anything it takes to win. But as a trainer for the Iron City Wrestling Academy and a supporter of Pittsburgh professional wrestling, I thought that the crowd on Saturday was just incredible. That was so special that IWC was able to put on a show like that. We had a special special appearance by famous actor David Arquette.
Oh.
So that was a special surprise for the people who came out. So you never know, everyone out there in Radio Land, you never know who will show up at an IWC wrestling show. You'll just have to come by and find out.
All right. That is local professional wrestler and trainer Chris LaRusso. Chris, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
And the next International Wrestling Cartel event is the first Pittsburgh Wrestling Classic, December 8th, and that's in Elizabeth, PA, and Chris will be in action. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, new first-of-its-kind data showed that black children and teens in Pennsylvania are disproportionately likely to experience foster care. However, on average, the Pennsylvania child welfare system provides more stable housing for youth than foster care. Today's program was engineered by Meg Fair, produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.
NPR News.